With his best-selling biography of Jack Kennedy, Chris Matthews shared a new look at one of America's most beloved presidents. Now with his new book, Bobby Kennedy, A Raging Spirit, Matthews returns with an in-depth, behind-the-scenes portrait of one of the great figures of the American 20th century. Overlooked by his father and overshadowed by his war hero brother, Bobby Kennedy was the perpetual underdog. Matthews says RFK would prove himself to be the rarest of politicians, both a pragmatist who knew how to get the job done and an unwavering idealist who could inspire millions. Chris Matthews is the author of MSNBC's Hardball. He is the author of Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero, as well as Tip and Gipper, and now Bobby Kennedy, A Raging Spirit. And we welcome Chris Matthews back to the roundtable. Chris, always great to have you on the program. Congratulations.
That was a great introduction. Thank you. That was as good as I could do.
Well, excellent. Thank you. So was it natural when you have spent time, certainly you have written a lot about the Kennedys, that when you spend time that you are eventually going to come to Bobby?
Because he was inside the whole time. I mean, the couple of books I wrote about Jack, I kept coming back to the fact that who's calling the shots here, Jack or Bobby? And Jack may have called the shots, but Bobby was the genius behind getting us through the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is the scariest nuclear moment in history. Bobby was the one that went to the Russian guy in the back channel, Georgi Bolshakov, and raised the issue of Turkish missiles we had, in Turkey, and said, how about we pull those out if you pull the yours out of Cuba? And it may not have sold it well at the time. It would not have sold well at all, but it's what got that thing off the dime. Otherwise, we would have had a fight, because Khrushchev was ready to move on Berlin if we moved on Cuba, and that would have set us up where we would have been forced to go to nuclear. It was a frightening situation. Bobby got us out of it. He did the same thing with civil rights. I got the tape where he was telling his brother, you know, that Robert Drew documentary. I'm looking at studying, and Bobby's the one in the room during the Birmingham crisis and then the fight in Tuscaloosa with George Wallace. He's the one saying, Jack, you have to go on television tonight. You have to go on the air and come out for civil rights. Tonight's the night. And the next night, Jack did it with Bobby's notes. So, I mean, it's hard for me to separate Jack from Bobby.
It is interesting in the book because it seems that, and at least this was my reading of it, that these two men needed each other very much in the sense that Jack learned from Bobby very much and Bobby learned from Jack very much.
I think you're right. I think it's symbiotic. Bobby needed the strength of Jack. I mean, you know, I've been a political advisor. I worked for Tip O'Neill all those years as an advisor, I guess, and I was in the back room with him telling him what I think he ought to do. But it's easier to do that as an advisor than to be the principal, to be the guy or woman out front whose face and being is the one that you're advising. It was very hard, for example, for Bobby to go from being the back room Machiavellian guy, like I was, to being the one out front and running yourself and saying, look at me, vote for me. That's uncomfortable for most people. It was for me. I mean, it would be for me. I think it's very hard to say, vote for me. It's a lot easier to sit next to the one and say, look, I can help you get elected. It's just a more comfortable position for some people, and for others, they'd rather be the one out front. So Bobby, when he had a transition to being a candidate himself, it was very difficult. He didn't like talking for himself or about himself, and he finally learned. He learned the hard way.
You know, obviously, we can talk a lot about politics, but there's also family politics as well, and there is also birth order and the very complicated nature of being a sibling. Where did Bobby fit into the family and his lot? I mentioned in the introduction that he was the perpetual underdog. How was he treated, and how did that form him?
The premise of my book is that it formed him completely, that he was the 5'8" brother of six-footers. He was the runt of the family. His father called him the runt, which must have gone over really well. He was the one who ended up being mama's pet because he was ignored and overlooked by the old man who had no time for him. The old man, being something of a narcissist, was focusing on his first son, Joe Jr., who's going to be the first Catholic president, and then it was Jack who's going to be the first Catholic president. Bobby never made the list. But I make the point strong in the book because I think all of us, like the poet Wordsworth said, the child is father to the man. We're all very aware every day we walk around what it was like to be 5 years old, what it was like to be in our family, where we fit in, where we didn't fit in, who was the favorite of the mom, who was the favorite of the dad. We all know that stuff. And some of it conflicts with our brothers. I've I think my brother, at least one of them, has a totally different notion of who are the pets and who are the favorites. But maybe that's how we survive, by trying to fight it. But it's always part of our life. If you start out the little guy, you're always the little guy. You start out the poor guy or the poor woman, you're always the poor guy. It doesn't change. It explains so much. Maybe Trump, the fact that he was from the boroughs of New York and not Manhattan, he was from Queens, was he could never get over the fact that he wasn't quite it in terms of society in New York or something that made him the way he is. But I think it really matters how you grow up. And he grew up the little kid, the runt.
Is it therapeutic to write about a political figure in our history at this time when all of this other stuff is going on?
Well, I mean, given all this about, harassment and all that stuff and sexual misconduct and all that stuff, it's not exactly uplifting, is it? I mean, I don't know how anybody can. This is all we're going to talk about, fine, I guess, for a while. But at some point, you're going to have to get back to the majestic in life. And even Trump doesn't exactly elevate you in terms of moral conscience. He's not a very moralistic guy, or moral even, perhaps. I don't know. But I think people want to have dreams. I mean, you want to have heroes. I mean, look at the other books on the bestseller list now. Grant.
Right.
General Grant is finally getting the attention he deserved, this great figure of history. And, I think we do, even if it's Hamilton, I think we have to go back and find, I love reading about great heroes. It makes me happy. I love Churchill. I'm glad there's a big Churchill movie coming out. Gary Oldman's doing it, and everybody's raving about it. How do you live without good moral leaders? I mean, without people to look up to? You don't want to look down all your life at the criminals and the bad people and the disappointing people, I guess is the better word for it. You know, I even had pretty good hopes for Trump coming into the presidency. I thought, he'd act presidential and he'd succeeded in business. He'd succeeded this. I thought his kids were pretty impressive when I first met them. The whole thing's just been disappointing. That's what it is. And to everybody, I think.
So,
and I think we need leaders. And if we can't have leaders, we need heroes. We need somebody from history that we can say, you know what? How about this? How about some empathy for people in trouble from our leaders? How about some unifying feeling? Why don't we have leaders who pull us together? Why don't we have a moral compass to tell us what they think is right and wrong? I think we need those things.
But and part of the problem is that it seems to be that the moral compass is all screwed up, because we have a president whose moral compass tells us that we should is defending a Senate candidate who allegedly sexually abused children. I mean, if that is a standard, and you have members of his own party who have distanced themselves and says we can't support this guy and can't put him in Senate, well, where's your moral compass then?
Yeah, I know. It's so tricky. I mean, molesters, and I don't even like the word molester, I don't tell you enough, but people who abuse children for sexual reasons end up being the ones who face the worst hell in prison. We know that story. Whether it's true or not, we grew up with that. You don't want to be a prisoner, among other prisoners, when you're known to be a sexual molester of children. You don't want to be one of those guys, because even among prisoners, that's the bad guy. We have laws like Megan's Law where you have to register to move into a neighborhood if you've had this in your past. So let's be honest, looking forward to the future, and what would be the behavior of Roy Moore? He apparently had this condition, this habit, or whatever you call it, back in addiction, maybe, back when he's 30-something. He's now 70-something, so that's 40 years ago. Has there been any evidence since, or a couple instances where he's misbehaved, but nothing of that child thing of his? I don't know. I don't know if it's a current affliction. I don't see any reason to believe it is, but It's a strange thing to elect somebody after we know this. And I think, being Christian about it and being nice about it, you still have to face the facts here. And all these women are credible. They all look like good people who remember in detail what happened. And you have to go, what are we putting here? What kind of person are we putting in the U.S. Senate? And is this what we want to have as a representative of our society? Or should this guy be going to a doctor right now? I don't know, but it's certainly not a moral compass to pick this guy, and I think the people down in Alabama are going to have to make that decision between a guy they agree with on the values questions of abortion and issues like that, and the person that they would like to see in terms of personal character representing them.
And I know we have to wrap up, but the one thing that I just want to end here is that 54 years ago, Bobby Kennedy's brother was assassinated. And so how do you look at this day and how we remember him and how we look at Bobby and put that into some context of where we are today?
When Bobby first heard that his brother had been shot, he thought it must have been a Southerner, a racist, somebody angry about the civil rights movement, and thought, hey, why aren't they should have shot me, because I was the one really leading that fight. And then he thought it might be the CIA, and he called up that John McCone, a fellow Catholic, and made him swear on his soul that it wasn't any CIA person or maverick in the CIA. And then, of course, he saw the report, and he basically bought the Warren Commission. There's always somewhere in the back of his mind a sense that it may have been something to do with one of the enemies of the family, with a mob or the anti-Castro people, or more likely the pro-Castro people. He didn't know, but he always had his people keep him up to date on what the latest rumors were. I think he got over it. I think he focused more on the gun issue. I think he focused on gun control. I think he focused in the later part of his life, not on the villains of his life, the mobsters, the communists, whatever, but on the victims. I think he just made a moral judgment in his life that as a family member said to me, that at some point in your life you learn that the villains of your life end up creating their own hells on earth. They just end up doing it, whoever it is. The mobsters, the mass shooters, they all end up in hell themselves on earth. So focus on the victims. That's something you can do something in your life, is focusing on the victims. I think Bobby made that profound decision.
Chris Matthews, have a beautiful Thanksgiving. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Again, Chris Matthews' new book is Bobby Kennedy, A Raging Spirit. He is the host of MSNBC's Hardball. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.